It's Coin Talk taped on Thursday night for the 10th anniversary of the Mining of the Genesis block. We did a special show with Tales from the Crypt, put on by Iterative Capital. It was a lot of fun. I hope you enjoy it. Maybe we'll do another one if another good opportunity presents itself. But thanks to all of the fans of Coin Talk who came out. I had no idea that people would show up. We will have a regularly scheduled show next week, but we're going to kick off 2019 here with our first ever live show.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Thursday, January 3rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $3,848.
Hello. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Lammer. This is Joey Kang. We host a podcast where we usually make fun of Bitcoin, which seems slightly harder now with the assembled audience of people here.
Yeah, we realized that this was our first real interaction with the Bitcoin community. And so we're feeling a little more nervous than we normally would.
We usually aren't even in the same room with each other. Like, I usually don't have to face you even when I'm making jokes.
Yeah, it's a very like interconnected world type of podcast where we don't see each other for months.
We both live in Brooklyn, but we tape primarily by Skype because of our deep laziness. Yeah. Mostly also because there was a period where every time we would try to tape, we would like set it in advance and there would be like a giant market move directly after we taped. So I feel like we've cut down our time a little bit through never seeing each other.
Yeah, that's true.
It feels a little awkward to be on the stage together.
Yeah. I feel like I barely know you.
So I want to thank Iterative Capital for having us. It is the 10th anniversary of the mining of the Genesis block. I thought if you would consent to join me, we could get back to one of our favorite topics, which is Satoshi as a literary figure. For people who haven't heard the show before, we generally are interested in the cultural narrative of crypto more so than the technology. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, mostly out of necessity.
Yeah, we have no idea what we're talking about.
Aaron and I both have, we both went to liberal arts schools and we both work in journalism, although Aaron will deny it.
Journalism, despite Jay's allegations.
I do work in journalism, and so our lens through a lot of these things, which I'm sure that has frustrated you about the media quite a bit, is never through the technology, but through the sort of allure of the stories themselves. And, you know, that's why recently there's been so many stories about people losing a lot of money because, you know, they're interested in those types of narratives. And we, as members of the fake news media, are also interested in that. So that's what our podcast is generally
about. As I was looking out at the sea of people, I was wondering, in this room, who do you think got the most wrecked?
I know. It's difficult to say. Like a lot of repeated places.
Okay, so since we both are from liberal arts colleges, I feel like we should consider maybe more expansively the white paper and the mining of the Genesis block. This whole era of history, as if it was the creation of a foundational text that we could talk about simply as text itself. What would be the like ways that we would pursue this as good liberal arts students?
Well, I mean, something that we talk about quite a bit is the idea of Bitcoin as a religion, and I'm sure you have all thought about it as well, and where the white paper exists in that space, whether it is a foundational text like the Bible or the Constitution and how people interact with it, or whether it's an evolving text that, you know, people take little bits out of and say, well, he was right here and maybe this is no longer relevant. And so we felt like the best way to do this, to talk about it, would be to use a literary analysis almost of what the white paper, how the white paper exists. So if you imagine yourself in what I imagine for you guys was a required English course that you took in college, and like that's kind of what we're trying to do here.
Well, there's like kind of two ways to think about a text. You can either think about it purely as the words on the page, nothing outside, and I think we could debate whether the blog posts are canon or not, the forum posts.
Yeah.
They're sort of quasi-canon, in my opinion. And then there's another way to look at it, which is what is the world that created this artist?
What were the external forces coming to bear in January 2009 that created the unique historical moment that led to the mining of this genesis?
Yeah, so you see this in poetry quite a bit, if you study poetry. Where you say, should we look at the words on the page themselves, or should we try and consider the context that created what was made? And I think that that actually is a somewhat relevant debate within crypto itself. I mean, you have a whole fork debate around Bitcoin Cash, which seems to be centered, at least from the words of the people who are doing it, on this idea, right? One of them is like, what was Satoshi's original vision? And another person says, well, you know, that is great and I respect that, but perhaps we should think about things in this sort of way. And so the idea of the original text, I think, is actually, and whether you think of it as something that's old and needs to be updated, or whether you think of it as a completely flawless and text, I think is actually at a very core part of the crypto universe.
So I did a very, very cold reread of the white paper on the train coming here. I wanted to delay it as long as possible. And the biggest that surprised me is how the language of the white paper speaks of the technology industry of the aughts, peer-to-peer, Tor, I think the Nutella network is mentioned in it possibly, maybe in a footnote. And it lays the groundwork for this different set of vocabulary, decentralization that comes after it, but none of that's actually in the paper.
Yeah.
That's all, like, it's kind of like when you remember, if you're like, hey, you remember The Godfather? That was a great movie. You're actually thinking of like two scenes from The Godfather right now, unless you've seen it a bunch of times. Like, your mind.
Or like, if you might be confusing it with like Godfather 2.
Yes.
Yeah. The scene I'm thinking from, I think, is from Godfather 2. Yeah.
So the other thing to think about would be what was happening in January 2009. And the biggest, if we were to say, to try and get the canon down to a single sentence, we would probably take the bit of text that's in the Genesis block about the bank bailout.
Yeah.
Expanding a little bigger, the white paper, expanding better than that, the blog post. So as this is happening, there's a great Wikipedia that's just what was happening every month of human history. So here's some things that were happening in January 2009. Obama was about to get inaugurated, bank bailout, number one song in the country, Single Ladies by Beyonce.
That was probably number one for a while.
And this was the biggest surprise to me. So we think of like when the iPhone came out, but in my opinion, the iPhone era really starts with the App Store, because until you can like load third-party software on there, many of the future outcomes of the smartphone weren't possible. Only 6 months into the App Store era.
Yeah.
At this point.
Well, what's the relevance of that to you?
Well, I was thinking as I was on the train here, coming here, why did this work? Why did this happen at the time it happened, not in the 90s when these other digital cash projects happened, not later when some of the stuff was a little bit more mature in terms of the technology in a phone? It was interesting to look back on how long it went from the mining of that Genesis block to the point where you could actually keep a Bitcoin wallet on your phone legitimately. The App Store allows that. So it depends, I guess, whether you think Bitcoin arrived early or late based on your expectations. But do you think that that unique historical moment said anything about it?
Well, sure. Like, I think that the bank bailouts were certainly, I mean, he states it very clearly. And I think that even within not just crypto culture, but any sort of economic culture that is trying to be in some way insurrectionary, the bank bailouts are the central event. You know, like even within sort of socialists who are not even Bernie supporters, but even harder left, like in America, like people who want to do also like the bank bailouts are the central event. And so this happening right after that, and him mentioning it, I think, you know, like it had to be the biggest driver of this action.
I'm going to be the devil's. We generally force ourselves to disagree on this show. So is it possible that we are reading some of that into it in retrospect? Like, what if the Genesis block is simply mentioning what was on the cover of that day's newspaper? It happens to be the bank balance. Do we have any definitive evidence in the text that this was intentional?
Well, no, but and there is a bit of evidence that that actually was on the front page of the Times of London and of a lot of other places, was that the thing that was on the front page was that. But I don't know, it seems like it's too big of a coincidence for me. I mean, if it had been something like, you know, like an attack or, you know, or any other thing, like, you know, like the Penguins win the Stanley Cup or something like that, then I would be like, this is probably not particularly relevant.
The Genesis block has Penguins win the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, or...
That is an alternate timeline that I would like to live in. It's a Pittsburgh sports fan, Satoshi.
Though that would have been actually quite, yeah, that would have been quite illuminating. We probably would know who he was at this point if it had said the Pittsburgh Penguins win the Stanley Cup. But I don't know. I think that that's definitely possible, and that generally I believe that, like, my general take on our podcast is that, like, most things that we try and derive out of coincidence in crypto, including like the market and news, is generally not actually correlated at all. And so I'm surprised that I'm having to defend the idea that this means anything. But I don't know. I do think it means something. And I think that if you read his semi-canon blog posts and his, like, messages with other people, that, you know, like, I think that the banking system was interesting to him. And it was something that did concern him quite deeply. But yeah, I don't know. I guess coincidence.
One of my favorite things that I came upon while revisiting this era was that, so the first block's mined, and then there's another block mined for like 6 days, and one of the possible explanations is, like, you've been in this situation where you, like, have an article that you're about to publish. Jay writes for the New York Times and Vice News and various places. You hit publish and you're like, oh crap, no, I have to do something.
Well,
and
then
you
unpublish it. We don't have power to hit publish at the Times.
And then you go back to it and the URL hash.
My editor is a dick. Publish, you know? Like, yes, but
the URL hash is the old date. Yeah, you're like, yeah. Oh, am I going to have to, fuck this, whatever. I'm just going to, like, let it sit. That's possibly in play. We don't even know exactly, like, what day these things exactly happened. Well, I like that explanation.
What are some of the explanations out there for the reason why there was this gap in time between the like this 6 day gap in time?
I have no idea. I did not do the full research to wrap my head around this, but I think that there's a real thing. Like, when we think about the movie of crypto sometimes. So
I think it's like half of our podcast is coming up with crypto movies.
So in the Satoshi movie,
most of them in coin, yeah, are about Bitcoin-topia and, like, and murder. It's like everyone is the road in Bitcoin-topia.
So in the movie, the moment of the mining the Genesis block is, like, where the character takes their plans and makes them real. It's kind of like a crossing the bridge from one reality into another. And so you imagine, like, you know, big strings, swelling music there. But for people who have actually participated in open source software projects, much more likely what would happen is, like, oh crap, I did not double check this. I need to go back and, you know, we don't know. This is possibly someone who has another life, a job, or whatever. There's, like, a lot of explanations why the, like, initial rollout would have been slightly bumpy.
Yeah. And I would err on the side of saying, like, those types of mistakes are much more compelling than him. I think that one of the explanations is that maybe he waited 6 days so that there would be news about the bank bailout so that he could seem like he was commenting on it.
This is like, I don't even know which
theory.
Side is the conspiracy.
Yeah, so, but I find that harder to believe than the idea that maybe he, like, forgot to do something and then went back, or maybe he, like, went on vacation or something.
We know that he was working on this starting in 2007, so it's not like he got the idea from the bank bailout. Like, this is in some ways, like, the narratives merging rather than them, like, mirroring each other.
Yeah, and if the white paper, and this goes back to the text itself, and if the white paper had been, the first sentences are about, like, the problem with, you know, commerce on the web is that third parties have to mediate it, right? It's the first sentences are not that, like, fiat currency is a huge problem and we should all return to the gold standard and stop eating vegetables and, you know, like go out and create like a libertarian utopia in the middle of Nevada. Like if it had been that, then I would have felt more strongly about it. But the aims of the actual text itself, when you read it there, it's a little bit harder to fit in that type of insurrectionary idea. And also, yeah, now that I think about it more, it is, you know, like the idea that 2008 was the bank bailouts were this seminal moment and led to all these different movements is something that journalists started writing about last year because it was the 10th anniversary. And we only think in round numbers. So it's like the first day of ever, this is like I don't know if any of you work in the media, but like on the first day of the year, people like go back and they're like, what happened 25 years ago?
Yeah,
I was doing that
this
morning.
Running calendar.
Yeah, I noticed that like
events.
The Gravediggers album came out 25 years ago. And I was like, I like that album. Maybe I'll write something about the 25th anniversary.
Well, I noticed the same thing about on my reread about this whole idea of commerce. Like the idea of censorship is never in the white paper. It's much more like, it's a big hassle. It's almost more like a pragmatic, like credit cards suck, there has to be a better way,
yeah,
kind of attitude, rather than this like grandiose libertarian thinking that comes in later. Interestingly, comparing that within the canon or no canon debate to the forum posts I would say are more on tilt.
Yeah.
They're like less objective about ideals behind the technology,
because he's not posing as an academic in those, right? Like he is much more in the hacker community there.
So you're saying there's like a code switching happening between the two?
Yes, and that I think that what this is totally like just my own speculation, but I find that the least convincing part of the original white paper is that Satoshi was an academic, even though it's formatted as an academic paper. And I have many reasons for that. Many years ago, I like tried to find, like all journalists, I tried to find Satoshi. I actually was like, I went to Dorian Nakamoto's house when all the other journalists were. If you like the video, maybe you'll see me standing there like, you know. But during that time, I talked to a lot of academics in the crypto space, and they were very skeptical that he was an academic. And it had everything to do with like the actual formatting of the paper, and it seemed like he was trying to make it look like an academic paper, and that he had succeeded, but he had little tells that made it seem like he was trying to do it. You know?
Well, the most unacademic thing about it is that he actually did it. Like, if there was a real paper, we would expect that he would publish it and try and, like, foist it upon people for the rest of his life.
Yeah, or there have been, like, 5 years of trying to raise funding.
Yeah, and he would have, like, his PhD students be like, hey, you should be working on my Bitcoin.
Yeah, how's my Bitcoin?
That's what academia
there
is actually
is,
like.
Yeah, that is true.
It's not like a guy who, like, actually, like, starts it in his garage. I mean, that is why this is the seminal moment. It's because it's unexpected. When we write this character, this guy who wrote this very terse, I would say very well-written document that laid out the life ideas of his work, you expect most people to just then become a crank and start mailing that to thousands of people.
Yeah, that's true. And most academics would not be able to write it so clearly.
It's rare to be the Satoshi / Unabomber who acts on your idea.
Well, the Unabomber was an academic. All right, so transitioning a little bit, like we wanted to think about like what was happening, like this idea of what was happening then, because we have a pet theory about what Satoshi was really mad at.
We do?
Yeah, we do. You'll remember it when I read this. So I actually do think it's useful to read the first part of it again. And these are the opening outside of the abstract. Commerce on the internet has come to rely almost exclusively on financial institutions serving as trusted third parties to process electronic payments. While the system works well enough for most transactions, it still suffers from the inherent weaknesses of the trust-based model. Completely non-reversible transactions are not really possible, since financial institutions cannot avoid mediating disputes. The cost of mediation increases transaction costs, limiting the minimum practical transaction size and cutting off the possibility for small casual transactions. And there is a broader cost in the loss of ability to make non-reversible payments for non-reversible services. Okay, so The key to this one, I can't believe we have talked about this on the show.
We've
talked about this show.
This is a topic near and dear to my heart. People who don't know me know that I've been involved in numerous shady PayPal transactions, both in the Craigslist and eBay capacity.
I've never met anyone who has bought more stuff off Craigslist than Aaron. So our pet theory, which we hope you guys will respond to and tell us if you think we're right or wrong, was that this seems like somebody who was trying to make transactions on the internet and was very frustrated by them, you know, and that if you think about what was happening in 2009, there's a lot of people buying things on eBay and using PayPal. So our pet theory, which we discussed on a show that one of us messed the
we
audio.
We forgot to record.
One of us messed
this
the audio.
This is actually just our second attempt to have this exact conversation. Yeah. Last time was just in total
was
vacuum.
That maybe,
not even recording.
Maybe Satoshi was like mad about PayPal. Was like something that if you believe that Dorian Nakamoto was Satoshi, for example, perhaps he was trying to buy some model trains. And that that somebody ripped him off with the model trains, and he was like, I can't reverse this. You know, I can't get my like $18 back for this caboose that I just bought. And he's like, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all the, I don't actually believe Dorian Nakamoto is Satoshi, but you know, all this like knowledge I took from DARPA, and I'm going to create this peer-to-peer cash. And I don't know. I actually still find that theory somewhat compelling.
Well,
it's been 2 months since we set it up.
There's a very petty, small version of that, and then there's like a grandiose, world-changing. The petty version is I was involved in an eBay deal gone bad. Because where else are people reversing transactions so much? I mean, there's a little bit in the credit card world, but in terms of like being personally burnt, unless you're running like an e-commerce storefront yourself, you're only getting burnt if you're buying things on eBay in 2008, right?
Though that was the part that we fixated on that we found, or that I still find somewhat interesting. It's like, what in 2009 was he trying to reverse the transactions for? You know, like was it like a maybe a flight or something like that? But then they would have just refunded his credit card. You know,
no, it's more
like
the like interpersonal. It's like deals where trust comes in.
Yeah,
but the more grandiose reading of our diagnosis that he has a grudge against PayPal. this is our like detective work come full circle. Is what was happening in 2009 was there was a generation of technology entrepreneurs who had come out of PayPal who were extremely influential in Silicon Valley and were investing in a lot of what would become the next generation of startups. And as someone who was working on extremely different takes on the same thing, potentially. You know how that feels when someone does something just like the thing you're doing and then it becomes wildly successful.
I've never done anything that the other iteration became wildly successful.
I think it's like a story as old as startup technology, that there's always an also-ran, there's always someone as if only if my vision had come through. And it makes sense that the phone, like the portable device in everyone's pocket, would be what would break the monopoly of something like PayPal, which is very much a desktop piece of software.
Okay.
You're not buying it?
No.
No.
No. I'm actually curious about something with the audience, which is how many of you still think the white paper is something that should be extremely influential in the way in which crypto goes forward, like that people should reference it and hold it to some esteem while making decisions.
How many people in this room have emailed or texted someone else the white paper? How many? So about 50% of the people have evangelized directly this document.
But it doesn't have to be evangelized.
How many people in this room have shared a religious text with another person? Okay, so spreading Bitcoin is more socially acceptable at this point, it seems, than
in this room, yeah. I think if we went to like Alabama or something, it would be different. I am curious though, it doesn't matter who, but you know who. Who does think it's influential? Like, why do you think it should be influential in this space? You had your hand up, man in the scarf.
I'm a journalist.
Oh, okay.
biased.
Yeah.
The most notable thing on rereading it for me was how many things are not there, like how many minefields it avoids. It's almost like I sort of agree with the, I don't know if this person is an academic, but it feels like someone who had participated in open source software projects before that had gone awry because people were overly prescriptive and overly dogmatic in the initial conception. And so it feels like a paper that someone cut a bunch of things out of because they're like, oh God, I know what this guy is going to say about this. And so it omits its most, in some ways, its most contentious issues are omitted. And what's left is not particularly arguable. Like, I don't think that if I were to challenge everyone in this room, what's the biggest schism two people would have in their reaction to this paper? There aren't a lot of fault lines there.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that helped it, though, gain such widespread acceptance and like that it wasn't about the things that people assumed that it was about? Like, it might, I think it probably was, you know, behind it probably was, but the fact that it was not explicitly about, you know, fiat currency and the banking system and everything like that, do you think that that helped onboard people who might have been turned off if, you know, if it had started with like, you know, my favorite economist is Ludwig von Mises or something like that?
I worked in publishing early in my career, and I felt like you could tell the book pitches from people who were too on tilt to write a book. Where like the introductory letter was kind of like ranting at you. And that's something you actually see a lot from like academic presses, from people who don't necessarily present their work to a wider audience. It seems like they're having a weird argument with like one guy at a different university. And then there are people who can write more broadly, who can address a less argumentative basic premise. And this feels like someone who's a veteran of a bunch of squabbling, like being like, these are the things we don't have to argue about. Now everyone else, figure out everything else. I'm not going to intercede. This is an absent God. Here's the text.
Yeah, but then he did spend time working on it, you know? So it's not like he totally abstracted himself from it. I don't know. I think that's a very deep reading into what's absent there, you know? I think that it's probably more likely that he went about being like, what is the simplest way that I can explain this in 8 pages without getting too much into the politics behind it? And I think he succeeded in that, you know? And I think that when presenting a technical academic paper, like, you don't front load it with all the politics that you believe, and you hope that they come out in the creation of the project. So I don't know, I think that maybe, and it's not so far from what you're saying, but I have a hard time believing that like he was consciously trying to avoid arguments that might happen. I don't even know what those arguments would have been, because I would think that most of the people who were working on this at the very beginning would have been aligned with those ideas.
Well, there's a lot of attention paid in the early time to bad actors and what will happen in various 51% attack situations, which is interesting, because it's, you're sitting at home about to print the very first block, and you're like thinking about like, what's gonna happen when some asshole comes and tries to fuck up my plans here?
Yeah, but that's what we did with Augur. Aaron and I were very early, we have massive gambling problems, and so we were early Augur adopters. And that was, when we talked about it, the first thought we had was like, could we get enough friends or enough rep to create a false outcome, you know? I don't know, I think it's a very obvious thing to think of. That's where our brains went first, right? Which is like,
yeah, but
like,
we already
we say that Trump didn't win the election? Or like, is there a way that we can say that, you know, like the house split of the midterms was this, if we get enough bad actors to work together?
Well, we already knew that it would be a crypto audience. What's interesting to me is that it seems like this document is predicting a bunch of people who are going to try to chip away at it and to try to be bad actors in the system. It comes from a very fundamental, suspicious, paranoid standpoint that human nature is going to be to try to exploit the system, which is prescient, because that is exactly what people do when there's more than a few thousand dollars at stake. I mean, there's already been an auto market.
That's true. And that actually is somewhat political, right? Because I think that if Satoshi was a Marxist, then he wouldn't be worried about the 51%. He wouldn't say that it's human nature to to do a 51% attack, he would have been said that it's human nature to for everyone to act in good faith and all of that. So, yeah.
So if you look at modern Marxist movements, there are now Marxist movements that are totally ignorant of the writings of Karl Marx.
Are there?
There are. There's a whole like Maoist insurgency in India.
Oh, yeah, that's
in
true,
rural
that's true.
Areas that is literally like unaware, like the foundational texts of Marxism are not part of their cultural practice.
Yeah.
Will we reach a point in Bitcoin, if it succeeds at the most grandiose level, where we see a generation totally forget all of this stuff?
Yeah, I think that it's starting to happen right now. It probably started to happen when the first centralized projects came out and they didn't even bother saying that they were decentralized in some sort of random way that, you know, is like a shell game that they're doing. And I think within a couple of years, even just because the timeline is so fast, you don't, outside of like Roger Ver and Craig Wright, like you don't hear talk about Satoshi at all. You don't really hear talk about decentralization, but the more I think Silicon Valley gets invested in this and the more that there are large corporations who are trying to make a centralized project, I think they'll probably win the information war pretty easily. You know, like I don't think that, and then at the point where they go back to saying, we should look at this text, I think that a lot of the politics won't be apparent in it. You know, because now we read it, we have a certain expectation of it. And I think in a few years they'll read it and be like, oh, this guy, you know, they'll be like us and be like, this guy seems mad at PayPal. You know, like this is about peer-to-peer transactions that are non-reversible. Why is this relevant to this massive thing that we're building? And I think they'll probably pay lip service to it. You know, it's similar to like, we're both NBA fans. It's like similar to NBA fans where you're, some people are like, well, George Mikan won like three championships and he won like three MVPs, but nobody really thinks that George Mikan was good, you know? They think that the NBA era started with Shaq or something like that, and so those are the things that are relevant to any type of comparison. And so I don't know, I think that's probably already happening with crypto. I just don't hear Satoshi being mentioned in any type of real crypto context outside of Twitter where people are just arguing.
Do you remember when we did an episode?
Do you hear it at all?
Well, something I remember, we did an episode where we got a bunch of Ripple fans angry at us. So we agreed to have one well-intentioned Ripple fan on the show.
Yeah, he was great.
To defend Ripple fans. And we were asking about like how he got so passionate about international bank transfers, because it's not a topic people usually get that passionate about. And he was like, well, I like the whole idea of cryptocurrencies, but I always thought it was a bit dodgy how there was this anonymous Satoshi guy. And I kind of was more comfortable with a vision that kind of cut that out of the story.
Yeah.
And that seemed ridiculous to me at the time. But as like a human inclination, it kind of makes sense. Like, we sanitize history in that way. And the fact that there's this enduring mystery in something that there's so much money at stake in, I think people ultimately will not want to linger on that idea.
Yeah, I go back and forth about this. Like, part of me thinks that is true, and the other part of me thinks that the mystery of it and the promise of something totally separate is what is still at the core of this, and that most people who are invested heavily in it, or the types of people that it takes to drive a movement like this forward, like necessitate that belief. And that if you take that away, then what is it? It's like it's tokens, right? And tokens are not interesting, except for the people who are making a lot of money off of tokens. And so I don't know. I think that it needs to have some central place still. Maybe not the white paper itself, but the general ideas that sprout around the white paper, or else it's just going to run out of gas. And at some point, like, people will get bored. I'm sure like a lot of people in this, given the market, are like starting to be like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. But if you believe in the ideas behind it, then you'll power on through, you know?
I think we need people to remember history. I think we're bad at remembering human history without these great people who come up with ideas. It's how we think of startups and technology. We have to like pair it up with a person. And we still haven't really in crypto come up with any meaningful, enduring characters other than Satoshi Nakamoto?
I don't know if that's true, like the Winklevoss twins.
Oh, yeah, you're like, your grandkids are going to be like, tell me about the Winklevosses, Jay.
Oh, yeah, I mean, if they see that Social Network. Vitalik. I actually disagree with that. I think the one thing that crypto does have is a lot of characters. You know?
I think it has a lot of big
It doesn't have a lot of products.
It doesn't have a lot of people characters. Who can stand outside their own time and also buy.
But you don't think that Vitalik is like a big character?
But by
like he was like when Ethereum was like at 12 cents or something like that. I remember some guy from Berlin emailed me and he was like, "You should do a story on this guy Vitalik." You know, Buterin, and I was like, I don't know who that is, but like, you know, it was, there were people who were interested in him back then, there's still people who are interested in him now, and it seems like he is sort of the character of it, right? Like, how many people have covered that guy and written about him?
I think that by remaining anonymous, you stand outside of time in the same way that, like, a movie star who dies young, like, James Dean will always be James Dean. There's something about like not like facing the consequences and the indignities of continued public life and just being sort of who you were at your best moment that it's going to be, I think it'll be hard to top that. I think it's going to be difficult for any person to embody so much of what crypto is more so than Satoshi.
Okay, so we'll finish on this because this is really the longest standing argument that Aaron and I had for like the year and a half or 2 years that we've been interested in crypto, which is that, do you think it's necessary for crypto to have big characters that drive the narrative of it and are evangelists of it, kind of like, you know, like Antopoulos or somebody like that that will stand on a stage and tell people, or even Roger Ver in the early days of Bitcoin, showing people like how to download a wallet and how, like, are those evangelists necessary, or do you think that the tech will take care of itself?
You're just gonna open this up to the entire room.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm an interactive person. Yeah.
I'd say in the short term yes, in the long term no.
In the long term no. But yeah. Do you feel satisfied with the people who are doing it right now in the short term? Depends on the day. Okay, yeah.
I mean, John McAfee.
Cool. Well, we do this show every week. Just search for Coin Talk in the podcast app of your choice. Send us an email. Let us know if you're listening. We really appreciate it. This is our very first ever live show.
This is our first one in front of a Bitcoin audience.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you for tolerating us, and stick around for the next set.
Thank you.
That was Coin Talk. Thanks so much to Iterative Capital for having us for our very first ever live show. Thank you to Tales from the Crypt. Great, great podcast. They did a set after us. They had the benefit of a far drunker audience. It was fantastic. I really recommend you check it out. I'll put it in the show notes, and you should definitely subscribe to them. Marty Bent, who is the host, is really funny, and I really enjoyed their set. Also, thanks to Chris Dannon from Iterative Capital, who invited us to do this show. Thanks to my co-host, Jay Kang. Thanks to our friends at Medium, who make this show possible. We'll do more live shows. If you have a great live show idea for us, let us know. Hi at cointalk.show. And we'll see you next week.